Our next talk is by Dr. David Weaver, Conservation Biological Control of Weak Stem Sawfly, Applying Agroecology to Enhance Integrated Pest Management.
So this is something that's going to be a little bit different. First of all, there are a lot of authors and affiliations here on the beginning. And this represents probably about 20 years worth of research. So these are former graduate students, some of who are in the room, current graduate students, colleagues, and also collaborators from other facilities. So for a quick outline, I'm going to do background on the wheat stem sawfly. Not everybody here is an expert. Talk about endemic native parasitoids, trap crops, and then I'll summarize. And we might as well just get into it since I was the guy who showed up a little bit late with his talk. So let's talk about wheat stem sawflies. They're early members of the Hymenoptera, so that means that they're in the Symphyta, or the group that doesn't include the honeybees. And they're in the Cephidae, grass sawflies. They specialize on them. They're located in semi-arid regions throughout the world in the northern hemisphere. There are a lot of them associated with crops in many areas. The diversity of populations that damage crops, as well as the species, is greatest at the origin of wheat cultivation. They occur in more than 50% of the world wheat crops, all in the northern hemisphere, probably about $2 billion a year in annual losses. In Montana, before wheat was grown, which was probably about 130 years ago, it was wheat stem sawfly habitat with short grass prairie and alpine meadows. And this is actually, well, your left is actually at 2,500 meters, and that's a wheat stem sawfly alpine meadow, and those stems on the ground have been cut by the wheat stem sawfly. So what we've done in this system is we still have alpine meadows. Sometimes cows are grazed there, and all the short grass prairie has been turned into cereal production. And we have a meta population because, like I said, the wheat stem sawfly is throughout that area. This is a slide from a few years ago, and it just looks at things on an increasing scale. On the left, actually on the right, we're looking at current arable crops. The blue ones would be host acreage. The red would be non-hosts. However, as I said, not everything is arable. So if we look at conservation reserve program acreage, the blue area increases significantly. And then if we take all the public grazing land and other areas, we can see that we have a very small proportion of the state not in host conditions for wheat stem sawfly. I hate these life table things, but it's a little bit important. The female on your right, emerges in the spring. That's actually her ovipositor inserted inside of the stem. If you can see that little black line, she lays a few eggs. They'll hatch in about a week. Young larvae start feeding. Feed throughout the season, boring through the stem and breaking the internodes. They have this weird aspect to their biology that they descend to the base of the stem as a crop ripens, and they girdle it. So what's called plant lodging there is actually a tipped over wheat stem where the plug has been made using mucus and frass, and the sawfly overwinters there. And that lodging also means that you can't recover stems. We collect all data using these. You have to dissect stems to look for parasitoids. You have to dissect stems to look for wheat stem sawflies. Losses in Montana from 2008 to 2014 have been estimated between 45 and 80 million. In the area of historic damage, which is on your right, we have about $350 million in losses annually. Damaging populations have been experienced since about 1910, which isn't so long after wheat was started growing. On your left, we have my drawing of the current known distribution of damaging wheat stem sawfly populations, or relict. And as you can see, we have a southward expansion of wheat stem sawfly, thus defying climate change, it is not increasing northward in Canada, just southward here. All the damage occurs by feeding of the immature stages. It's all inside of the stem. We have about 10% due to feeding, decreased head weight, unrecoverable stems is another 10 to 15%. And the more lodging there is, the greater the losses. Those challenges might be of interest to people interested in agroecology. This insect itself will take away wheat stubble, which will decrease snow retention. It'll make harvesting slower because the wheat is fall in one direction as a result of combining, burning more fuel. You may have to swath, damage equipment, picking up rocks. And then we have a lot of volunteer wheat because the wheat that falls on the ground germinates in the fall, which uses water, which we don't want, and excess herbicide. Quickly, some management attempts. This is one of the most common practices that occurs now in Montana, and I'm not going to talk about host plant resistance with solid stem crops today. So what a lot of growers do is they plant the highest yielding wheat varieties and say, we're going to swath, and we don't need to worry about wheat stem sawfly problems. So it saves them a little money in the heavy infestation scenario, but what happens is the whole process continues or worsens infestation. The money is lost directly in kernel weight. It's 10 to 30% loss with no correction, and although it's believed that it reduces larval survival, it does so only when losses are occurred. So if you cut when it's too green, that's when you can kill a few of the sawflies, but you lose quality. These are some older studies that were redone a few years ago. This is tilling the residue, and it's important to note that the survival in exposed bare crowns containing the wheat stem sawfly was only about 10 or 15%, but the survival in the soil-associated crowns was about 85 to 90%. The most you could get up on the soil surface is about 50%. This is some very old work on burning residue. Where basically, if you burn a field, it causes no appreciable mortality in the stubble. And in 1920, Ainslie actually reviewed Criddle's work in 1907, right at the bottom there. And what Criddle did was he piled a bunch of straw on top of residue and burned the whole works to see if it could kill them, and it still didn't work. Natural enemies. Okay, these are in the Apocryta with the honeybees. There are two species of Burkhan parasitoids that attack wheat stem sawfly. If you're not an entomologist, well, this will be kind of fun. They're sympatric, spatially and temporally. They're congeneric. They're in the same genus. Two populations per year attack the larvae on the surface. They're ediobionts, so they paralyze the larvae and feed on it. They're specialists on wheat stem sawfly. Their ovigeny is uncertain, meaning we don't know how many eggs are available to parasitized sawflies when they first emerge, and some egg maturation has to occur for them to be successful because they emerge at the same time their hosts do, but they attack the large larvae inside the stem, as shown here. This little female here has to find the sawfly larva inside a stem, then she reaches the point where the sawfly is, drives the ovipositor through the stem, lays an egg, the egg hatches, the larva is paralyzed, the larva starts feeding on the sawfly, spins a cocoon, comes out about 7 days later. That little bullet hole is not any economic loss. That's a good thing. One of the species is also gregarious, meaning you can get up to four parasitoids for one wheat stem sawfly. One of the great advantages of the wheat stem sawfly parasitoids are that they retain yield. In a paper we did in 2008, we can show that the two black bars that are highest encircled there and the adjacent gray bars both show that stems where the sawflies died or were parasitized had the highest yields. And then a colleague, Brian Barris, did the same sort of work a few years later. And so in the red box, he's got two categories, stem solidness and rate of parasitism. And The rate of parasitism on wheat stem sawfly in the blue circle is negatively correlated with how much solidity is there, there is in the stem. That's host plant resistance. Then when he relates it to grain yield, stem solidness, the higher part of that circle, is negatively correlated, but the presence of these parasitoids is positively correlated. So in other words, his research reinforces ours. So that's great. You get immediate benefit in yield right at the time of parasitism. Okay, so this was taken about, in the last millennium. So, and this is basically a direct proportion projection of about 200 meters off of basically alternate wheat fields. And the practice here is to have about 2.25 million hectares of wheat, which in this case are in the brown, and about the same amount fallow, which is the golden wheat residue you see here. This is winter wheat planted at that time when growers predominantly planted winter wheat by tilling the ground and planting the seed that way. So as you can see, the landscape is wheat and fallow as far as the eye can see. It doesn't look quite like that anymore. So one of the things that was happening at the time we started doing this work was we went into zero-till systems with use of herbicide. But in a lot of cases, we were able to compare on either side of a field a herbicide-treated area with a light tillage area, or sometimes with even a heavy tilled area. This is not from there. Obviously, that's not dry enough soil. And these are paired comparisons. So this is looking at the level of infestation. Each of these is a tilled Kemphalo paired set of fields from several years. And this is looking at the number of sawfly eggs as illustrated. And as you can see, the tilled and Kemphalo are not very different in most cases. Maybe the infestation is higher in tilled in some cases, and in others in fallow. However, these are the parasitoids. And yet you can see in most cases, the parasitoid numbers, the rate of parasitism, this is a percentage on the y-axis, is much greater than the tilled. And that changes the proportion of stem cutting. So you can see that in the 1998 chart, several of them have a complete absence of stem cutting. No sawflies survived to cut the stems in the chem fallow fields, only in the tilled fields. So in other words, we have a situation where tillage has a negative impact on the parasitoids. Sawfly overwinter in the underground stubs that I showed you earlier. Parasitoids overwinter in the above ground part of the stems. Tilling buries them. They're not able to emerge from that. So not tilling and using a herbicide actually conserves parasitoids. Well, so those parasitoids I just mentioned are buried. So let's now talk about the impact of harvest. In particular, as I showed you earlier, that's a parasitoid cocoon in a stem, which is where the parasitoid will overwinter in the remaining wheat stubble. They can take temperatures to about minus 48 degrees C with about 25% glycerol in their bodies at that time. So one of the questions we asked is, where are these parasitoids and what is the impact of cutting or harvest heights? And this is a fairly simple thing I did from Scott Muir's master's project. So basically the way to interpret this is data from one field, and the green section is the number of parasitoids in the total number that are below one-third of the height, the red bar and below on the stylized wheat stem. Below the blue is two-thirds of the stem height, and the green is how many parasitoids of the total population are in the two-thirds to the bottom of the head. So if we look at this, we actually did this a number of fields. And so this is a frequency at each level, and you can't see the axes very well, but on your right, on your left, is the lowest number. So the biggest bars are at the bottom, and these are at two fields in in Alberta and two in Montana. And the number of parasitoids in the sample is in the first set of parentheses, and the estimated number per hectare is in the second set. A is the first generation of these bivoltine organisms. B is the second, the ones that overwinter. 2003, we switched out a couple of fields in Canada because the numbers were low. You see the same sort of thing. The parasitoids are at the base of the stems. So Scott Muir's project was not only to have all those stems split to find out where they were in the stem, but also look at harvest heights. And as you can see here, we have plots of varying combine heights, which also impacts the amount of snow that's retained. That doesn't bother the parasitoids. And basically, this is the same stylized wheat on the other side this time. And basically, looking at the heights, the one-third treatments, which is either chopped at the harvest or left whole, two-thirds, are all statistically similar. If you get up to the heads off, you get a statistically significant advantage in parasitoid numbers. And if you didn't harvest the wheat at all, that was not different than just harvesting the heads, begging stripper header harvesters as being a logical choice. But the key point here is if you leave tall residue, you're probably going to save most of your parasitoids. This is actually from a grower's field. The outer edge is where sawfly damage is the worst. Those are the short pieces of residue. When he got to the interior and the sawfly cutting was lower, he just simply raised his header height and conserved more parasitoids. He's totally happy with doing this and says he has no more wheat stem sawflies. That's hard to believe. One great thing about these is that they're bivoltine, so they survive after harvest, especially if you conserve the height. So this is a bit of a complicated illustration. The right side that you see is actually a solid stem wheat. The black are the numbers of sawflies per 30 centimeter samples. The red is the number of parasitoids per the same sample. The blue divides the numbers in the wheat before harvest. We gathered the wheat and split the stems. The other side is the after harvest. And you can see that in both cases, the number of parasitoids for this grower are greater than the number of pests. And not only that, the bivoltine stages perform very well after harvest, where you see the red bar is much more exaggerated than the black. So conservation feeds into post-harvest very well. Okay, trap crops. I put it in apostrophe because it's kind of different. First of all, the grass we're interested in is smooth brome. It has been suggested as a dead-end trap crop. A number of early recommendations from extension services. They even have techniques on how to do this. We'll focus on this one really quickly. Basically, the one we're interested in is the one on the right, the blue, which is a permanent trap of smooth brome around the field edge. To mimic this, Ryan Bixenman did the following. He looked at smooth brome adjacent to crop fallow systems on either side of a road running these transects. Stems were dissected. This is the comparison of oviposition by the wheat stem sawfly. They're eggs. And it's the proportion of stems infested. Smooth brome is more infested than wheat. The eggs per stem are also greater. Smooth brome more so than wheat. Sawfly mortality is higher in smooth brome than wheat. That's a gray bar. Parasitoids are higher and cause more mortality in smooth brome. There are more parasitoids overall in infested stems in smooth brome. Sawfly cutting is also lower in smooth brome. Smooth brome is a source of parasitoids and a sink for wheat stem sawfly. Therefore, in an agro-ecosystem perspective, a grass periphery, which is the area that you can't plant the wheat in, can have a greater value than expected. Even surrounding a very large wheat field of approximately 250 hectares on average. This is just a tiny mention of cover crops. There's a lot of very exciting research going on now, and we're looking at actually the very beginnings of this work, where we're looking at sugar nutrition by these parasitoids and also flowering species. And this is just one teaser. You can see that I have buckwheat emphasized in this table below. And buckwheat increased the longevity by about 6 times as much as any other thing, including buckwheat that we cut the flowers off in a laboratory experiment. So nectar is probably important to these. Summary. Native parasitoids and host pest species have moved into cultivated in wheat. This represents a change from perennial to annual monoculture vegetation that cannot be restored. In other words, we can't really go back. So any strategy that furthers sustainability and resilience can be applied to conservation biocontrol of wheat stem sawfly by the native existing parasitoids. Considerable complexity exists in these systems, and they must be studied by ecological observation experimentation. Demonstrating an immediate benefit in yield from parasitism events is very compelling to growers. New crop rotations, cover crops, and attention to ecosystem services will only promise greater gains in integrated pest management. And right now, we've got about 2.25 million hectares of wheat in Montana, and we have about 500,000 hectares of legumes and other flowering crops. So we're getting more diverse. This was funded by a lot of people. Some of this work was back in the days of the glory days when earmarks existed. They're not all bad, especially if you get them. Any questions? I'm probably burned that. No wheat stem sawfly lovers out there? Oh.
How large an area does the benefit of adding higher stubble height from leading edge of the sawfly stand? So we have localized areas where superheader adoption is very high. In a localized area with enough adoption of that technology, we think we'll see a difference in the parasitoids in those areas, or is it very within a field?
Well, in Montana, you can't find fields that have wheat stem sawflies without parasitoids. So they're long-standing. If you're in Nebraska, where outbreaks are occurring now, parasitoids are just starting to move into the wheat that's been infested by wheat stem sawfly. So I would encourage any attempt that you can have to conserve the height of the standing stubble is going to be beneficial. The parasitoids are probably adapting from the surroundings and taking the sawflies. And therefore, there's going to be a few that you might not spot right away, but doing the best you can to maintain them is certainly the best approach.
Thank you, David, so much.
Thank you. Sorry about that.